Welcome to Access Advocacy on thepowerofvoices.com. I'm Adrienne Shapiro, and the goals of Access Advocacy are to improve the lives of patients and caregivers who are dealing with the chronic illness of sickle cell disease. And my co-founder, Nancy Renee, is also here.
Hi, everybody. It's good to be here. We have a great show for you today and something that we've been working on for a few months now. And that is to talk a little bit about the Passages program at Children's Hospital LA. We have with us Annie Nord, who's the nurse navigator, Dr. Jackie Baskin, who is the medical director, Dawn Canada, who's the program coordinator, and Kelly Russell, who's the project coordinator. So welcome, everyone. We're glad to have you on our podcast. Let's start, Dr. Baskin, with you. If you'll tell us a little bit about Passages and how it came to be.
Well, actually, I joined the group a little bit later. So Annie was previously a research nurse working with patients with sickle cell disease, particularly with young adults. And Dawn is our social worker for our patients with sickle cell disease. And a lot of what they were noticing is that our young adults, as they were growing up, had challenges with finding adult care and continuing with proper care after they left pediatric care. And then I joined in as a physician a few years after they started talking about this. And so together we put together a program to see how we could improve the care, get patients connected for these young adults with sickle cell disease.
Okay, so Annie, it sort of sounds like you were in this program from the beginning. Tell us a little bit more specifically what happened, how you got everything together.
Well, as Dr. Baskin said, before this current position I'm in now, I was a research nurse, and we did some fairly big research trials on some new medication here for patients on chronic transfusions. And this position, my position as a research nurse, gave me an opportunity to spend more time with patients and get to know them better and their families better over a period of years. And so as the study progressed and I got to know these families very well, I also saw them growing up. And wanted to know what happened after they left our care, because as a bedside nurse, when I used to work in the clinic, they would just become young adults, and then suddenly they wouldn't be getting our care anymore, but I never knew, like, what happened to them. And so I went to Dawn one day about a specific patient and asked what happens now. She's going to be 21 soon. Where does she go? And that started this conversation between Dawn and I on what does transition mean? What happens to our young adult patients when they leave their pediatric medical home? And what can we do as providers and the people who take care of them as children growing up into young adulthood? What can we do to help them with that transition? And so that conversation started probably 7 or 8 years ago. That's where it started.
So, Dawn, what happened? You're the coordinator. I'm assuming that your job was to help the young adults get connected to doctors, specialists in the area that treat sickle cell disease. What happened that made you think that, yeah, we need to have some kind of a program in place?
Well, actually, we really weren't doing official connections with patients previously to our program. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of them kind of fell through the cracks and began to kind of access adult care on their own or began going to emergency rooms. And so what really started us thinking about it more was that for the longest, patients could still be hospitalized here when they were in their early 20s. And so I believe that was part of the reason there wasn't a whole lot of emphasis placed on it, because some were still coming back. But they had put into place an age-out policy at Children's where basically said that once a patient reached 21 years of age, technically they could no longer be hospitalized here because we are a pediatric facility. And for us, that was a huge red flag, because now we really didn't have any way to really kind of help them with their care once they reached a certain point in terms of being hospitalized. And so I believe that was the motivator that really stoked the fire under us to try to get something going.
Well, I know for us, that was really, you've heard me talk about it, going from adult to adult care, from pediatric care. As a parent and a patient, we had no idea that there was even an age out. And when Marissa was in the hospital over her birthday, and she had her birthday, and when they actually celebrated and gave her cake and everything, and then they realized how old she was. And immediately, I mean, literally, we took the bed from Peds and pushed it over the bridge to the adult side of the hospital. It was, it was jarring, to say the least. If not totally disconnected, it was jarring.
Well, and we need to point out that Marissa, Adrian's daughter, was not a patient at Children's, so she was at a hospital that did have adult services. And yet, you know, our data from the CDC tells us that, and you wouldn't think this would be true, that young adulthood is a high risk of mortality for people with sickle cell disease. And you would think, well, my goodness, you know, they're getting good care as children. Now they're 17, 18, 19 years old. What is it that's causing this steep rise in mortality? And I'm going to throw that question out to you women from Children's, because you're there working with people all the time, and I have a feeling that you can answer that question. Dr. Baskin, I'm going to start with you. What do you think is causing the high level of mortality with young adults with sickle cell disease?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the issues is when there is not a transition program in place, when there's not a way to actually connect them to adult physicians, if patients are trying to find their care out on their own. As Don and Annie had mentioned, a lot of them, instead of getting connected with adult providers, don't get connected at all and are being seen in emergency departments or getting hospitalized. And a lot of times they may be getting care by physicians that are not really familiar with sickle cell disease, and that will have an impact on their care. So I think that is at least one of the major issues that some of our young adult patients are facing once they're no longer being taken care of in a pediatric facility.
You know, one of the things that I've heard people say is that young adults are just not very good with their health care. They don't keep appointments. They don't take their medications regularly. And Adrian, I know you've been through that because your daughter is no longer a young adult. Did you find that was part of the issue, or was the issue something else? Because to me, unless we pinpoint what the issue really is, then we're going to be unlikely to find solutions to that problem. So, Adrian, what happened when Marissa went through that pushing the bed over the bridge, as you described?
Well, what was really, I think for me, the most important thing to learn during that phase is that she really was just the normal kid. She was a normal teenager who was turning into a young adult and was behaving. At the time, I thought, oh, she's just, you know, everything was sickle cell. Until I really started to dig into some books on adolescent and early adult behavior, and I realized that, no, she was just, you know, a normal young adult who thought she would live forever, wanted to do everything on her own terms, and saw the disease, saw myself, mom, saw the doctors, is all impeding her and trying to stop her from living her life. So, there was the pattern of pushback when I said, did you take your hydroxyurea? Are you doing this? Are you wearing, you know, the normal mom things, which when she was younger, I could get away with just saying, I'm the mom. Do this.
Right.
So I think that for me was the biggest leap, was understanding that it wasn't just sickle cell, but it was just normal behavior. And when you add to that, a life where a lot of your lessons are learned on how to deal with adults and how to deal with your health and how to deal with being in the hospital, you learn at really, really young ages. And so how do you get them to see themselves as young adults and behave in an adult way when many, many of the things they had learned in terms of taking care of themselves and interacting with people of authority, i.e. the nurses, social workers, doctors, they had learned as young as three, you know, four, five, when research tells us a lot of their perception of the world and where they fit in has already developed. So that's why I'm so excited about this program. So how do you guys go about helping these adult young adults? How do you retrain them?
This is Dawn speaking. I laugh because everything that you describe is so developmentally appropriate for teenagers and young adults. You know, it is a time when they are really questioning a lot of the things that they have been taught and trying to establish what works for them. So, you know, you're absolutely right when you talk about that developmental stage definitely impacting how smooth or lack thereof that a transition can go. For us, we've begun to just really try to begin to teach them at an early age what is the importance of various lifestyle habits or things that they do in line with their medical condition and try to normalize it to a certain extent and still give them the ability to advocate for themselves, kind of like empowering them, so to speak, with this aspect of their life. And we always emphasize that sickle cell is just a part of who they are. It is not necessarily who they are, and how to work within that as they are identifying their own identity. It is not an easy task, and it's one that we've begun to try to address moving forward for our younger patients as we realize that this whole process really needs to start sooner than later. So we've begun to look at our 12-year-olds and begin this slight process.
Well, you know, I'm glad to hear you say that. As everybody knows, as I mention him all the time, my grandson is 13 now, and you know, this is a kid who's not real good about remembering to bring his jacket home from school, even though it's raining and he needs his jacket to keep dry. He still forgets it. So some of that, which is just lack of focus for younger teens, just becomes magnified when you try to work with the sickle cell child. In my grandson case, he's not rebelling, or at least I don't see it that way. I just see him as being scattered in his thinking, lacking focus, being more interested in the friends and what his friends have to say and who he's going to go home with, you know, and all of that kind of thing. And sickle cell is the last thing on his mind. Do any of you have any ideas for those who have teenagers in their families trying to begin this process?
This is Annie. I wanted to circle back to what Dawn was kind of piggyback off what Dawn was talking about, but also part of, you know, when we see this change when they leave pediatric care into the adult health care system, is that they're often not, they're not equipped for the adult care system. They don't have the knowledge base to draw from, because up until they have to leave our facility, everything is taken care of for them. And so what happens when they leave us, if they're not connected with someone, the care often becomes fragmented, and they have a difficult time navigating it. I know me, as a healthy adult, have a hard time navigating the adult healthcare system. But somebody with a chronic disease, it becomes even more challenging when you look at insurance issues, medication issues, hospitalization, and so trying to teach them at a younger age too, which is part of our program, is what to expect when you leave your pediatric home to as you move into adult health care, because it's very different.
You know, yeah. Annie, as you say that, and you talk about the knowledge base, you know, so many people, I think, have talked about the knowledge base of sickle cell disease. I know my grandson's nurse has talked to him about why he has to take hydroxyurea and why, you know, being well hydrated is a good idea. But all of this about insurance, I'm a college-educated adult, but I don't understand it, and now we're getting ready to go through some kind of change. Nobody knows really what or when that change will happen, but understanding, you know, the whole insurance thing, how to get your medication, is your medication on the formulary and all of that. Do you have any suggestions, anything that you're doing as you're working with your young adults that are formerly or about to be formerly children's hospital patients to help them understand that whole insurance piece of it?
We are working on educating them about the insurance, and that landscape continues to change. I'm sorry, by the way, this is Dawn. That landscape continues to change. So part of the education is just helping them understand the difference between, let's say, managed care Medi-Cal and straight Medi-Cal, how CCS drops off, how to identify a primary care provider, and how that operates within the managed care plan. So the education tries to hit those more salient points that we have to really hit home to help them understand in terms of helping them navigate the adult health care. But I also wanted to make just a couple of other points, and one of those was that you had asked about teenagers and their parents and how we would talk to them, and pretty much, you know, there is no blueprint on working with teenagers. I mean, you can do your best, and there are still many that are going to do what they want to do. The risks are just higher with someone who has a medical condition in terms of this trial and error that teens have to go through. But I remember distinctly that one of my parents often told me that transition is not just for the child, it is for the parent. Mm-hmm. So part of what we're trying to do is not only help parents to give patients more responsibility in increments, but to also help them understand that, you know, even when we do all of that, they still might bump their heads a little bit, and how to minimize that the best you can. So, you know, you just try to give them the education about their disease, the possible consequences of what that is, how to really understand how their care of their disease process fits into the type of life that they see for themselves in terms of the future, the importance of their health, and try to support both of them through that process.
So interesting about you're saying, because one of the things that I guess from my journey, what I've gleaned is that the parents have to transition along with the child. And I think the transition, unlike when with Marissa, when doctors were still quoting a very early, a probability of a very early death. So much of the focus was keeping her alive. And so other things such as what's going to happen when she's a teenager, of course, was all secondary. And now in retrospect that I've had this journey, I truly, truly believe that the transition starts right away. You know, at that first, when you get the letter that tells you that the child has the disease, but certainly those first hospitalizations that with the parent, you have to understand that you have to be watchful of everything, but that your job is going to be to look at what's going on, to be able to then interpret what's going on to your child and try to look for opportunities for the child to take some ownership. It's parenting, but it's hair parenting on steroids, I think.
That's a good name for it.
Yeah. This is Annie. I think one thing we've learned as we build this program, we continue to build our program, is that every patient is individualized. We're trying to create systems and processes that we can use across all patients and ages, but then when it comes down to the actual transition, every patient's situation, support system, family, if they have parents there to still support them in the process, they have advocates for them, their social lot, you know, their social part of it, that it's so individual for every patient. And so we have to look at that also, is that it's not a one-size-fits-all program. It's very individualized.
You mentioned being socialized. I just see this from my knowledge of teenagers. That was my career before I got involved with sickle cell, was teaching children in junior high and high school. And, boy, their social lives are really the most important thing. They're more important than lots of things that we adults might think of as important. But who likes them? Who do they like? What crowd can they hang with? What is that crowd going to do? Are they cool? Are they not cool? And it's, to me, unless we figure out a way to help them come to grips with all of those issues, that whole social influence is going to undermine a lot of what you're trying to do. So whoever wants to respond to that, because I know parents out there are looking for help.
Go ahead, team. Are you asking basically how parents can help kind of offset some of the social influences that their teens might be experiencing, which may be negatively impacting their health care?
Yes, and even things that wouldn't be negative for most kids. It's summer,
right.
You're invited to a barbecue, the people have a pool, and everybody's going to go swimming, except
right.
Maybe your kid shouldn't go swimming. Helping them deal with that, because they'll get very angry. I mean, slamming doors and throwing stuff angry. The anger might be directed at you, but you know that the anger is directed at the disease and at the limitations that you're trying to place on the child so that they don't come home and go into a crisis because they've been in a pool for several hours. Those kinds of things that wouldn't be a problem for most parents and most families. So I'm not talking about drinking and drugs and all of that stuff. I'm talking about just typical stuff that lots of kids want to do.
Right, and I think that kind of ties right into what Adrian was talking about parenting on steroids, because the things that you bring up in terms of social pressures on teens is really just part of that stage. Peers are very important, and wanting to fit in and not be different than not wanting to stand out from. So typically they're already going to have those issues. But when it comes to their health, I remember one of my parents told me that what she kind of did was she allowed her son to find what his limits were regarding his health. So let's take the swimming issue. We can educate both parent and patient, and parent can continue to reinforce that with patient. And when they're younger, can actually enforce it. But when they are older, and if they're out hanging out with their friends someplace, let's say at the beach or at a swim party or whatnot, you're hoping that those things kick in. But at the same time, if that child decides, well, I'm going to try to swim and I'm going to see what happens or what my limits might be. This one particular parent said that it really helped her child kind of find what the boundaries were for himself, in terms of not so much all of what she said, because there were times when maybe it didn't kind of plan out or pay out the way that we said it would, because as you know, sickle cell is different for every patient pretty much and how it manifests. And so that kind of helped that particular child kind of begin to establish their own boundaries based on the knowledge we gave them, as well as the freedom that his mother gave him to kind of test the limits where his disease process was concerned.
That makes sense? That's really a great response, because, you know, that's what we want to teach our kids, whether they're healthy, whether they have a chronic disease, whether they have something else going on, is to know themselves, know what their own boundaries are. Mm-hmm. And one thing I'm wondering, would it make sense to try to get the child with sickle cell to talk about his disease just a little with one or two of his close friends, so that he has maybe a network of kids that will help him kind of get to know himself and know when he's pushing the things? Have any of you had experience with that, with kids whose friends sort of help them know right from wrong in terms of their sickle cell disease?
This is Dawn, and rarely, because it is really an isolation type of thing. I have kids that are coming here to the hospital regularly who might go to the same school and never knew that the other one had mm-hmm. sickle cell. So I think, you know, that kind of ties into very few have confided in me that they actually have spoken with even their closest friends about this disease. Most of them have opted not to even disclose to peers. But we had to try to address that in terms of, you know, we do have a support group at Passages for kids that are between 16 and actually 26, where we would hope that it would give them a forum to be able to talk about their experiences with others who might have the same types of experiences and or suggestions and or advice. And even though the group is not really large, the interactions that have taken place have been really interesting between my older patients and my younger patients in terms of different limits that people have tried, or in terms of things that they've been able to achieve despite their sickle cell, or in terms of how to adjust their goals. For instance, if you're trying to go to college, don't get discouraged if you're not able to keep up with your friends who have gone straight through college in 4 years. Maybe your path will be a little longer because of possible interruptions you may have due to your illness, but you can still achieve these goals and still take care of your health in the process.
Right, that sounds great. Adrian, I'm going to go back to you because you're kind of our resident expert, as having been through this with Marissa. Was she able to disclose? Did you think it was an important thing for her to do, or let her keep to her privacy? What happened?
Well, again, knowing, you know, again, fourth generation mother with a child with sickle cell, we never, ever felt it was safe for Marissa to be with people who did not know she had sickle cell. Mm-hmm. And so we told everybody, and we had note cards. And everywhere she went, a note card was in her bag. If we were leaving her with someone who was looking after her, the teachers knew, everybody knew, she knew. Mm-hmm. And she could tell you from, I think, 18 months old. But she did have a very good friend who we didn't know the friend had sickle cell until we were boarding the train to go down for sickle cell camp. And yet this child had been at my house for parties and sleepovers. And the mom felt that it, you know, it was something to keep to oneself. So again, I think this goes back really to that parent training. And that early on, the parent needs to understand how important it is for the child to be able to speak openly about having sickle cell, but how everybody really should know in case something does go wrong, so to speak. So we're going to take a break. You're on Access Advocacy on thepowerofvoices.com, and we are speaking with Dawn, Annie, and Jackie, the team for the Passages program at Children's Hospital. We'll be right back. Thank you. This is Access Advocacy, and we're speaking with the Passages team from Children's Hospital. So I was thinking while you were talking, if I were to get to have a do-over, I would have my child at your hospital. And could you step me through what would happen? Would I have to apply for the Passages program? How does that work? And how would she, quote unquote, graduate from it?
Okay. Dr. Baskin, you want to take that one?
Sure. So this is something that's really available for all of our patients that we care for in hematology. We focus mostly not only on sickle cell disease, but other diseases that affect red blood cells. There are other blood diseases that we take care of. And it's really something that is there for all of our patients because we do think that it is important. So all of the patients that we take care of for their hematologic issues or for their blood problems, it's also available. And so this is a new program, and so we're still working on our systems. But essentially what we're starting to do is discuss with patients early on, as we mentioned, the importance of transition and getting the patient more involved in their own care and really starting to talk to them between the ages of 12 and 14, starting to try to have them participate in their clinic appointments, even trying to speak to them by themselves to kind of see where they're at as far as their understanding of their condition, and having them ask their own questions, really starting to get them more involved. As they get a little bit older, 16, 17 years of age, we actually have developed a transition clinic. So this is a clinic that's run by myself, our social workers, so Dawn, as well as one of our other social workers, Michelle, and Annie, as our nurse navigator, as well as some of our nurse practitioners who follow a lot of these patients as well. And during those clinic visits, which is completely separate from their regular medical visits, because the focus and the goal of those transition clinic visits is really how can we best prepare them to move between pediatric and adult care. And part of that is getting them to understand their own disease, getting them to understand sickle cell better, their medications. That's more of the medical component. And the more of the social work component is also talking about insurance, discussing that early so they can get a better understanding of that, as well as the importance of connecting to adult doctors. And so we're starting to introduce the ideas early and then continuing to work on it in more detail as they move along. And the idea is to really get them more prepared by the time they're turning 18, 19, 20, and 21 to really have a better understanding. And so they feel more comfortable once they get to that age and do need to go see adult doctors. They have a better idea of what that might look like.
Again, I am lessons learned, right? So under the transition program, we've talked a lot about making sure that the child and parent are educated on the disease, making sure that they're seeing, you know, the hematologist. There are separate visits from what I think of as a well checkup kind of visit. There's also a visit when you're unwell. There's something to do. Is there a mental health component to your program? Because I feel like this would be an ideal place for that to be, and to get the children to just into their natural way of being, know that it's okay to talk to someone about their feelings about having sickle cell.
Right. This is Dawn speaking. And no, there is not a mental health component actually built into the program, but there are mental health resources available to through Children's for our patients. So that would be something that I think we would look at down the line in terms of how we would actually incorporate that. But for those who are having difficulty coping with the diagnoses or with any other issues, we do have access to psychologists and psychiatrists here at Children's that can follow them. Unfortunately, a majority of my patients are not open to mental health services for one reason or another. So it is not a service that is readily used.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was thinking that if it were a part of the treatment early on, then it becomes something that's just known and part of the the treatment, which would make them more open to that. I mean, we all know that life is better when you have someone who sits and listens to you.
Yeah, I agree.
So just a thought, I mean, we do know that there's a combination, there's the disease, there are the effects of the disease, there's the effects of not enough oxygen in the body, there are silent strokes, there's the stigma, there are the pain meds, all of those affect the mental state of the child and the caregivers. And I guess I would see a very strong reason to build that component in, whether or not the patient is exhibiting, I guess, physical signs of the stress. So something to think about.
You know, we've talked a lot about insurance, but I want to ask some specific questions because there's so much that I personally don't understand. Let's say that there is a child with sickle cell disease who hasn't had a severe illness. His pediatrician and pediatric specialist is part of his parents' insurance. So he can stay on his parents' insurance until he's 26, but he can't stay with that pediatrician, hematologist, much past the age of 18 or 19. So now he needs to go in through the database of doctors on parents' insurance to find a doctor that will treat sickle cell disease. Do I have that correct?
Well, it depends. I mean, for patients who have private insurance, that's pretty much the gist of it. But then it also depends on if that private insurance is a PPO, which gives you more opportunity to kind of work outside of a network as opposed to an HMO, which locks you into a network. It's so convoluted once you start talking about insurance. So that's kind of a little bit right in terms of if a family has private insurance.
Okay. So now a child that's got a more severe illness is part of California Children's Services.
Generally, well, the severity,
is that the case?
No, the severity of the illness does not determine if a patient qualifies for California Children's Services or what we've been calling CCS.
Okay.
CCS is based on the diagnoses, one, which is sickle cell is a qualifier, but then it is also based on a family's annual income. So
okay.
Generally, families who have Medi-Cal and who have sickle cell will automatically qualify for CCS from the financial component. For those families who have private insurance or HMOs, they qualify from the diagnostic perspective, but may or may not qualify from the financial perspective.
Okay, okay. All right. So let's say now we have a patient and family who's been on Medi-Cal, and so now the patient is, again, 18 or 19, they would remain on Medi-Cal, is that correct? And then still try to find a doctor from, you know, and I'm not talking about necessarily Children's Hospital where you guys have some programs that are intended to help families find a position. I'm just talking about, you know, a family who hasn't been to Children's, is going somewhere else for their care, and now they have to find a doctor in the Medi-Cal system that will treat them. How does that work?
In general, if a patient has Medi-Cal, and CCS and is on a Medi-Cal managed care plan or an HMO, being the same thing, then they are good under CCS until they're 21. And their Medi-Cal will continue under the managed care plan if the Affordable Care Act remains in place where there is still that coverage for patients that are between 21 and 26. However, in terms of finding the hematologist for them, it'll depend on what medical group they are connected in. So every medical group has hematologists, and that patient would then just access that hematologist through their group.
And would most hematologists, I get confused because you're not supposed to discriminate. Let's say that this law is the law that we know it now, because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. But now the family is not supposed to be denied coverage because of the pre-existing condition of sickle cell disease. Mm-hmm. But in some of these groups, how does a family know whether or not the hematologist is okay with taking a sickle cell patient, or will they say, that's beyond my scope of practice?
They really won't know that until, you know, a lot will depend upon the relationship that they have with their primary care provider or whoever's following their sickle cell as a pediatric patient. However, if they don't have a good relationship with those providers and they're trying to access a new adult hematologist, they will not know if that person is qualified to take care of their sickle cell or if they're comfortable with them until they actually have that first visit. And at that first visit, I would encourage that patient and their family to ask that provider specific questions about their expertise, about the number of patients that they that they already follow, about their desire to follow patients with sickle cell, about how they manage the pain of their patients with sickle cell. And if those answers are not satisfactory for them, then it's up to that family to contact their primary care provider and tell them they want another hematologist and or change out of that group altogether. So it's really a trial and error if you're not familiar with your network or if your pediatric provider does not give you the name of someone in the network that can follow you. So that's for your general person. That's not for someone in our program.
Right, but that's great information because, you know, we have the way the internet works, we have people all over the country and we have people in foreign countries that listen to this show. So we have some people that say, oh, yeah, okay, I know Children's, but there are people from wherever that are trying to see how this would work, and maybe their pediatric hematologist hasn't even discussed any of this with them, even though their child may be 16, 17, 18 years old. It mm-hmm. just doesn't happen.
So this is really, I mean, in hearing this discussion and getting this great advice, I can see how if you have started working with the children at 12 and 13 years of age and asking questions and feeling comfortable and confident about what they know about their disease and what they require, I could see them being better equipped to go through this vetting process. It's also my understanding that you have the ability to, if you have a special condition, if you are signed into a plan, a managed plan, and that group you have does not have someone that is an expert, that they will allow you to switch plans.
But they should.
But mm-hmm. what you know? But I can just kind of see the power of what you're saying once it gets going. If you've got the child at 11 and 12 in a room with adults who hold the power, right? And you're mm-hmm. teaching them how to interact. What is the role of the navigator? The navigator? We hear that word used a lot. Patient navigator. Yeah. So in your program,
yeah, and it's navigator is used in different contexts. It was originally, I think, created for oncology or cancer, breast cancer patients, where physicians and medical practices would use other patients who'd been through the similar experience to help patients navigate the system of, you know, their medical care and what their needs would be. And so that term navigator sort of has morphed into different things. It means different things in different places depending on where you're at. For us, the nurse navigator in my role is to connect the two medical components in our program. So it's to connect the adult medical care with the pediatric medical care, and to ensure that it's as sort of effortless and smooth process as possible. So it's connecting with the adult provider, seeing what their needs are for this specific patient, providing them with medical summaries, paperwork, cover letter, medical records, whatever, you know, and scans, whatever they need, they will need to be able to take care of that patient fully, to have a good understanding even before that patient steps foot into their clinic. And then when needed, connecting the pediatric provider with the adult provider so they can have a conversation over the phone on the specific needs of this patient. And this is not required for every patient, but some of the patients that are a little more complicated and have multiple medical conditions from their sickle cell disease, sometimes the two physicians need to have a conversation on the care. And so it's just ensuring that that medical communication, that medical piece is in place for that patient. And it's also a place for the adult provider to know that they can always call back and turn to, you know, me as a nurse navigator to get questions answered. If they have a question about, you know, one of our patients that they're taking care of now, they can come and contact me, call me, email me. Sometimes they usually have their staff do that. And I can get that information for them.
And this is Dawn. I'd like to expound more on Annie's role, because it is a pivotal role in our program. And let me kind of give you an illustration of what it looks like in connecting a patient with an adult provider. So if we have a patient that we're trying to transition to an adult provider, we as a team, and that's the three of us on the phone, look at not only their medical issues, any psychosocial issues that are going on, as well as logistically where they live at, and look at the providers that we are already familiar with. We then decide which provider might be the best fit for that. But if that patient's insurance doesn't allow them access to that provider, then we help them change their insurance around so that they can access that provider. And then Annie will contact that provider to make sure that provider is open to receiving this patient's care. And then we'll connect, like she said, the adult provider and the pediatric provider to discuss the patient, usually before the patient actually has that first visit. And once she has put all those things together and that sent over to the adult provider to continue to help them know this patient, then she will follow back up with that provider after that visit, as well as the patient, to see how that visit goes. She remains the link between the pediatric and the adult provider, even beyond that initial first visit. And that's the other unique feature of this program, is that we do a kind of co-management plan for those providers who need more support than others, so that the communication can go on beyond that first or second visit until that patient is comfortable and that provider is comfortable in taking care of that patient. So her role is really key, and it's a key unique factor about our program in general.
Well, I really see her as the bridge. Annie, you're the
bridge.
She's the bridge. Right,
I think that having that bridge is what really takes care of that thing that we were seeing, where there was this gap, as Nancy mentioned, or like a drop-off, right? You suddenly age out and there's no one there. There's nothing there. How does the new doctor get in, you know, the adult doctor get in touch with the pediatric doctor? So, that's really great. So I know that you guys have been thinking about this, thought about it for a long time, and it's taken you a long time to implement this program, and it's ongoing, and it's changing as you see needs, and I know it's going to grow. Do you have any real need for help from us? Is there something that we as the listeners can do? I think I heard you say if we knew of hematologists that we knew we're working with people with sickle cell, we should let you know. What can we do to help you help us?
Well, that right there is really key. If you know of a good hematologist, or even, you know, internists are often also managing patients with sickle cell with additional support that are open to taking care of patients with sickle cell disease. You know, we are looking for patients, providers who want to take care of our patients. And that would be great information for us as we continue our community outreach to see if we can fit those providers into our network.
You've talked about support groups for the patients. Do you have support education group for family members?
Not yet.
Ooh. that sort of sounds like an advocacy kind of thing, you know, to get those of us, like Adrian, you know, to get those of us who have been through it or are going through it, because there's nothing better, at least in my way of thinking, than talking to another parent. And I think that's one of the difficulties with sickle cell disease or with any chronic disease, is you need a safe place to kind of let your hair down and talk about all of the issues that you can't quite talk about with your friends because there's too much stuff that they don't understand. So I would certainly want to encourage you, and I know Adrian and I would both be willing to help in putting together a support group for the parents of the young adults so that they have a place where they can deal with the issues that we're all dealing with.
It's a great idea. I mean, we've thought of so many different things that we want to do, and yeah, we definitely want to be able to provide additional support for our parents. And so I would hope that probably sometime this year we'll have some kind of framework of what we're looking at in terms of what we can do and who we can partner with to provide maybe some more services to our patients and families around transition issues.
Well, I see a second show.
Yes. In a few months.
And we've been known to find other work for people. you're doing that? Oh, that's really great. And what about this? So given that, I really want to thank you so very much. If someone wants to know more about your program, where would they go on your website to find out about it?
Well, I think since our website is not really up to speed, what they can do is they can either email us at Passages, PASSAGES at CHLA.USC.EDU, or they can call our Passages number at area code 323-361-7096, and we can address any questions or comments or assistance they might want to give us through those means. We're more than happy to have anyone call us.
Okay.
Aren't we mean?
All right, so Kelly, thank you. Don, thank you. Annie, thank you. And Jackie, want to thank you for taking your time out. And we really, really, truly want to thank you for the work you're doing.
Great. Thank you so much
for
having us.
Thank you for having us on your show. Appreciate it.
And we'll be right back. We're just about out of time, but before we go, I wanted to let you know that you can learn more about our organization on our website, accessadvocacy.org, or on the Access Advocacy Facebook page. That's AXISAdvocacy.org. Join us again next Tuesday on thepowerofvoices.com at noon Pacific, or listen anytime on demand at accessadvocacy.org. You'll find all our programs there. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. Thank you for listening.
Pushing, I've got to keep on pushing.